Whilst that's loading up, I can declare I have no interests, apart from obviously the ones that were foregoing in my biog. It's very embarrassing when somebody says that and you're standing there. It's my pleasure to talk to you in this session on protecting rights and assuring those rights. I think my role here, on behalf of myself and my colleague Andrew Fraser, who does send his apologies, unfortunately, he was unable to get away from Scotland at the moment, is to help putting a context on the approach that can occur within a jurisdiction which operates where state, national, and international oversight of civil rights of prisoners in the delivery and experience of health and healthcare is part and parcel of the everyday world. So if you like, this is a snapshot of what could happen rather than what is happening in the US. I want to very quickly cover issues in relation to governance within the Scottish prison system. Now, I think it's worthwhile just mentioning the UK has four countries, and since there was a devolution of health and justice department responsibilities to those four UK countries, it's no longer appropriate to talk about the UK as if somehow it had one system. Now, in fact, Scotland never had the same system as England and Wales, because Scotland, ever since the Act of Union of 1703, has never quite got round to actually accepting England as being part of the same country. A little bit of a problem, but those who've seen Braveheart might understand why. I then want to talk a little bit about the proportionality of that governance. Actually, there are some downsides as well as upsides to actually having standards-based approaches to ensuring that rights are being maintained. And finally, I want to draw some conclusions from that, which may help explore, to help be explored in later presentations. Okay, can we? I think it's fair to say that the Scottish prison system is subject to a high degree of governance. And that's not just governance within healthcare terms. Now, I will talk primarily about healthcare governance. But the kind of governance that I'm going to describe for health terms actually occurs in relation to its standards for as correctional facility. So on top of anything I'm talking about for health and healthcare, there are other standards, there are other requirements which are being placed on Scottish prisons in relation to the way in which those rights of prisoners and the rights of those who work within those prisons are being maintained and supported in the context of justice. Obviously, UK is a signatory to the UN Optional Protocol in the Convention Against Torture, and as some of you will know, in May last year, 2009, the UK put in place its National Preventative Mechanism. There are 18 bodies which form that National Preventative Mechanism within the UK, five of them in Scotland. So in a country of 5 million, you've got five national oversight organisations, all of whom have vested interest in how prison healthcare systems operate. And they will run through not only the Inspectorate of Prisons, they look at areas such as an organisation called the Care Commission, which is responsible for social and accommodation standards within institutional facilities. There are areas in relation to the Inspectorate of Police to ensure that the security elements between the prison to the outside world are managed and maintained. You name it, those oversight bodies can go in and do what they like. On top of which, Scotland's prevention of torture scrutiny includes the Council of Europe Committee, who have rights to come in and undertake scrutiny. And also there is a legal oversight. You'll recall that the UK and the Scottish legal system have actually enshrined the European Convention on Human Rights within UK law, and as such, there is always the potential for legal challenge, irrespective of any oversight that comes from external governance bodies. I'll probably come back to that in a minute. Healthcare governance, interestingly enough, is not part of the UK National Preventative Mechanism. But there are oversight bodies in relation to healthcare governance which operate in common to mainstream clinical practice within Scotland. So in effect, the standards which healthcare provision within Scottish prisons are governed are exactly the same as an NHS hospital or family doctor service or community provision in any nationally delivered public service. Interestingly enough, they're also the same standards that operate within the much more limited private sector providers that actually exist within the UK as well. Same basic standards, blind to facility. Important point to make. These cover not just healthcare standards for delivery of treatment and intervention and prevention services. I'll touch a little bit more on that in a minute. They also cover standards in relation to the audit and assurance of systems. So there are standards for how you self-audit and how you quality assure what you're doing, which are themselves subject to a standard which you have to show evidence that you have met the standard so that anything you produce using your audit and assurance processes are actually of an appropriate standard as well. Compliance is, as it is everywhere else, somebody comes in and says, have you done it? Independent oversight, checking against those assurance processes. On top of which, there are clinical governance arrangements. Now, clinical governance is something that we all kind of sit in there and say, well, what does that really mean? Fundamentally, it is, are you using the right kind of staffing with the right skill mix and the right professional competences to undertake the work that they are employed to do? And are they working in systems which give them the opportunity to be able to practice in a professional way? That's quite important in the context of correctional medicine or correctional healthcare. The degree to which you can ensure that the healthcare is provided by somebody who is not just professionally accountable, but professionally competent, is clearly something that we take as a given. But we have to show that that's true and be prepared to allow others to see it, that it's true. I mentioned that there are standards for healthcare delivery. Within the Scottish Prison Service, we've actually established 13 standards for the delivery of healthcare. And these are there. I'm sorry for those of you at the back who kind of need a set of binoculars. I wanted to do it on one slide rather than two. These range from, if you can imagine a pathway, from the moment of a reception into prison in terms of an immediate healthcare assessment, right the way through to discharge and planning for discharge and liberation. There are special areas in relation to primary care services, mental health services. Interestingly enough, the Scottish prison officer is probably one of the most highly trained mental health care workers at level one. So those who are in terms of identifying, supporting individuals with mental health issues, either in terms of emotional well-being promotion or to be supported to access healthcare services of any professional body with or any professional working group within Scotland. There are more prison officers working in that than there are people trained in mental health promotion within our family nursing structures, for example. Bloodborne virus services, management of medicine, drug services, there's the full bit that you'd expect in there. The one that's missing is actual sexual health services. There was no willingness, I'll put it that way, to actually include a healthcare standard in relation to sexual health services. Doesn't mean to say it doesn't happen. In most cases, GOM clinics are offered within prison environments across Scotland on an in-reach basis from the local NHS services anyway. I think it's more to do with the Presbyterian approach that Scotland doesn't have sex, and certainly not in prisons. In terms of the type of consequences of those standards, there are a range of governance committees which are formally structured within the Prison Service Administration to ensure consistency and equity of action and application. These would be mimicked as in every single one of the Scottish Health Boards, the NHS commissioning agencies. They will all have a Drugs and Therapeutic Committee. They will all have a Health Protection Committee. They all have mechanisms for actually ensuring that health promotion is being delivered. In that sense, the Scottish Prison Service Oversight has already created for itself an equivalent type of structure that we would expect to see in a large NHS organisation. And rightly so, because actually they are dealing with an extremely vulnerable group of people in terms of healthcare experiences prior to incarceration, and if not well managed in prison, after incarceration. There is a National Suicide Risk Management Group with external lay oversight. NGO is non-governmental organisation. In this case, it's voluntary sector organisations. That's important because actually suicide risk is probably one of the most important areas that is of concern in relation to transfer into the prison environment. I'll come on to why we're quite concerned with that and some of its consequences in a minute. Given there is special custody provision for people with forensic mental health needs, there is a separate, specialised prison just dealing with forensic patients in Scotland. Similarly, there are specialist provision for women offenders, which includes specialist women and children units, and is quite happily coping with pregnant women who are incarcerated and support for them postpartum. And also there is a specialist young offenders unit. If one or two of you want to know about the young offenders unit, I can give you some interesting comments about equality of access to services, where actually being in the young offenders unit gives you a better chance of getting access to certain types of services than being within the community outside. We're concerned about suicides not just because it's the right thing to do. There is a statutory requirement in the UK that every death in custody is subject to external independent review. So once somebody dies in custody, in fact, whether it's in a police cell or whether it's in a prison, there are external organisations that have to formally review this and have right to public publication of their findings, and those findings are binding. In Scotland, they're subject to what's known as a fatal accident inquiry. This is the equivalent to, a local medical examiner's investigation of the reasons around cause of death, and if there is anything which relates to criminal or institutional culpability in relation to that death, they have ability to highlight and make binding recommendations. In England and Wales, they're subject to an ombudsman investigation. That's slightly less serious, if you like, in terms of how you respond to it. But at least in England and Wales, that includes near death. Whereas in Scotland, it's just death. So you've actually got to die in Scotland, but it's more serious if you die. If you don't quite die in England, then somebody comes around and has a look at you. There's something in there about the different psyches, I'm sure, but I won't explore it. What links all these together is this approach within the UK that uses standards as a mechanism to assess the operation of legislative and governance frameworks. And if those are derived from rights, whether from the European human rights legislation or any other right statement, it gets reflected in a framework, legislative, for which standards are developed and then used to assess the quality of what you've done, both in delivery terms and in outcome terms. That's the relationship. Frankly, if you say that you're rights-based and you don't have standards to interpret whether the rights have or haven't been delivered, you've missed the point, in my opinion. I'm sure there are some in the States who think that's probably true. But it does give rise to an interesting question. We consider we've got a pretty sophisticated and robust approach to this sort of governance. But is it over-sophisticated? Do we actually need to go to this level? A standard setting, audit, assurance, compliance, independent oversight, just to make sure that a prisoner actually gets to see a dentist once a year? Surely you just have to give them the choice and make the dentist available and they'll go. But even if they don't, it's been there and that was good enough. Tick, they were there. Arguably, it is over-sophisticated. It does come with a high management and operational cost. And it also creates an interesting problem around isolation from mainstream services, because what you're doing is you're setting standards within the context of a setting, the correctional setting. And as a result of that, whilst those standards may mimic those which are operating within the rest of the National Health Service in Scotland, the interpretation of standards in terms of the operational delivery may vary. And therefore, you might actually end up with two sets of one standard being met, two different operationalizations, both of them actually saying much the same thing, but the delivery ends up being different and the outcome may be different. But actually, you're okay. The standards are there. You've matched them. Has it had the desired effect? Well, no. And you've just proved a whole load of you met the standard, but it didn't have the right outcome. The investigation of critical incidents encourages very defensive practice. Earlier on this afternoon, I spoke at a separate session that some of you were at where we discussed this notion of equality and how you manage equality and rights versus values inequality. If you have a rights base, you open yourself up to legislation, which can be tested. Because where there's a right, there's a wrong, and if you're shown to be wrong, you can be subject to prosecution. We all accept that. That's the nature of legislative structure. But which is better? To actually wait until somebody takes you to court and proves that you were wrong, and until such time as that case law is developed, you just keep steady as she goes. Doesn't cost you anything. Depends whether or not anyone really wants to take issue with it. Look at California's prison healthcare system. Or do you actually try and keep on the right side of the legislative framework and use standards as a means of defending any accusation that's made against you? In the UK, we try and avoid legislation at all costs. That's because we have this strange view that if somebody rules, we actually follow. And we do it. And if we don't do it, people lose their jobs. There's also those who argue, no, because actually the very fact that you can undertake those sorts of investigations, reviews, have given rise to some of our best developments. You know, reports in relation to low standards of care that came out following the Ramsbottom reports in the 1996 gave rise ultimately to the transfer of responsibility for prison healthcare from Ministry of Justice to Ministry of Health jurisdiction. The infected prisoner blood donors scandal in France in 1999 has given rise to worldwide responses in relation to bloodborne virus interventions. And certainly, before I came here, I was talking with our three hepatitis C specialist nurses who NHS Lothian employed to go into just the two prisons within the Edinburgh area. And that's independent of the existing nursing structures that are there within the prison itself. Also, developments have emerged really about these issues of how you can use different sets of standards. I mentioned standards in justice as well as in health, which give rise to balancing budgetary requirement. If you are within the Ministry of Justice, you're in the business of trying to ensure that a prison remains appropriately restrictive for the individual, that their restriction to their rights to liberty because of their actions, which have been judged in a court of law to have been beyond the legal framework, are managed and maintained, but in a way which is suitable to the standard that you have set for incarceration, the custody part of the equation. But in doing that, you've actually got to ensure that their rights to health care are appropriately supported. And that's a balancing act in terms of how you budget for it. Not just in terms of healthcare delivery, but in terms of justice outcomes too. Every time a prisoner comes out of a Scottish prison to go to an NHS hospital for the provision of, for example, a coronary artery bypass graft, two members of prison staff have to accompany them. Because that's the standard for escorts. And that costs the governor, not the NHS. And we can't transfer them in ambulances provided by the NHS. They actually have to come in specialist provision, in which nurses go into a prison environment or paramedics go into a prison van to bring them back across, which costs us. There's also a whole issue around the volume and the quality of service, and I think that's probably the same reflection that's going on here in the States about how much and to what level you actually provide this for. Whether that's a rights-based or a values-based decision is actually less to do than the budgetary requirement. And I think there is an economic value we have to really bear in mind here at a time of austerity. I don't like saying that, but it's true. So in conclusion, I hope you can see that our arrangements do reflect a formal framework of human rights, in our case, the European framework of human rights. But they also reflect a governmental commitment to equity in healthcare. Scotland is actually making great strides in transferring its prison responsibilities for healthcare from its justice jurisdiction to its healthcare jurisdiction. And in doing so, is saying the setting in which the person is irrelevant to the standard of healthcare that is delivered for them. Now, that does create some interesting problems. I've already said, if you're a young offender, certain types of healthcare are much easier inside HMP, Her Majesty's Prison, Bolment, than it is within the wider community. I can guarantee you will get 16 weeks residential detox for substance misuse the minute you walk into any of the Scottish prisons. No problems. I've got a waiting list out in the community if I want to do that for one of my vulnerable people in Lothian. The history of problems in the past actually have to be learned from. It's not that they're there. You actually need organisations with a memory. And that memory, in my opinion, needs to be linked to a conscience. But the minimum is a memory, and that memory actually then gives rise to systematic solutions rather than little local solutions. And finally, I think I've shown that our arrangements do try and avoid litigation, perhaps. It's always still a possibility. And as we're about to find out, as some of you may have noticed recently, the Scottish evidential base for the 6 hours unaccompanied by your lawyer in police custody. Did any of you see this? No? Yes? Wonderful aside. If you're a Scottish resident, and the police think you may have undertaken a crime, they can take you, at the moment, they couldn't take you off the streets for 6 hours and subject you to full, legally binding interview, which are of a sufficient evidence for submission to the court, and you have no right to legal representation during that 6 hours. Well, up until 3 weeks ago, you could. That's no longer the case. Emergency legislation was taken through the Scottish Parliament to actually outlaw that. We're waiting for the first case for somebody in a prison to turn around and say, I was convicted on hour four evidence. It's no longer valid. Watch this space. Thank you very much.